From Colorado Public Radio, this is a Colorado Vote special. I'm Ryan Warner. In less than a week, things could look radically different. Voters might have elected a new president. Control of the Colorado House and Senate might have switched hands. And marijuana might be legal. Or the political landscape might not have changed much at all. Except the ads. Whatever the outcome of this election, the political ads airing in this swing state of ours will have stopped. You have that to look forward to. But until then, you have a chance to hear the best of CPR's election coverage so far. And we'll start this hour with that effort to make Colorado the first state to legalize marijuana, specifically up to an ounce for people 21 and older. CPR's Ben Marcus reports.
Visitors to Colorado could be forgiven for thinking marijuana was already legal. Denver alone is home to more than 200 marijuana dispensaries operating out of retail storefronts scattered throughout the city. But that's for medical marijuana. Only patients with approved ailments can access the pot in those shops. That means many people are still buying the drug on the black market.
About 80% or more of the marijuana that's being consumed in Colorado is being purchased and sold illegally.
Mason Tevert runs the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol, otherwise known as Amendment 64.
That's a big underground market that still exists here, and we can take that underground market, make it into a legitimate market where we're controlling the product, we're collecting taxes, and so on.
Medical marijuana businesses in Denver last year paid nearly $3 million in taxes to the city. That number is expected to jump dramatically if marijuana is legalized. Tevert spearheaded a failed effort to legalize the drug in 2006. This time, he's got a lot of money. $1.3 million so far, most raised from a pro-legalization group in D.C. It's given him a 4-to-1 money advantage over the pot opponents, enough to spend on commercials like this.
Dear Mom, when I was in college, I used to drink a lot. It was kind of crazy. But now that I'm older, I prefer to use marijuana. It's less harmful to my body. I don't get
Tevert says for communities concerned about marijuana, Amendment 64 gives them a lot of power.
They maintain the ability to prohibit marijuana businesses if they prefer. They can regulate it, license it however they see fit. They can regulate advertising, signage, security, whatever they want to do, but they cannot just completely make marijuana illegal for adults.
That all sounds good to former Congressman Tom Tancredo, who's a strong advocate for legalization. The deeply conservative libertarian says the state should not be regulating what people put in their bodies, and he says America's multi-billion-dollar drug war has been a failure.
I'd rather not give money to the cartels, and I would rather stop spending billions of dollars, and I'd rather stop throwing 10,000 people a year in Colorado in jail because of this.
Guys like Tancredo say the regulated model for medical marijuana works, and it should be expanded, in part, to put the bad guys out of business. But Roger Sherman disagrees. The longtime political consultant is the campaign director for Smart Colorado, a coalition working to defeat Amendment 64. He says the state has shown it can't regulate even the limited nature of the business today. A few dispensary owners have recently been busted for trying to smuggle hundreds of pounds of marijuana to other states.
If we're going to grow that, we become the donor states, the supplier states for Wyoming and Nebraska and Kansas. And it's just not what Colorado needs to be known for.
That echoes Governor John Hickenlooper's comments recently when he said in a statement, quote, "Colorado is known for many great things. Marijuana should not be one of them." Sherman says it's those great things that attract businesses to the state.
We attract a healthy workforce. We attract entrepreneurs. We're focused on education and how we do a better job at educating our kids. And legalization of marijuana runs counter to all of those.
Hickenlooper's not the only high-profile politician opposed to legalization. At a recent press conference, Denver Mayor Michael Hancock forcefully denounced the measure.
I am here to say very clearly that Amendment 64 is wrong for Denver and it's wrong for Colorado.
And he speaks from experience.
I come from a family that has a long history of a sister and a loved one who's been involved in drugs. And the reality is that people need to understand that these are the real cost of this.
Hancock says marijuana led to the abuse of harder drugs in his family, and he'll never tell his own kids that marijuana is okay. Opponents of legalization often point to the potential impact on kids. Dr. Christian Thurstone runs one of the state's largest drug treatment centers at Denver Health.
So the kids we're seeing in treatment now are telling us, Hey, Doc, why would I want to stop using marijuana? It's going to be legal anyway in 2 weeks, right? And these are 15-year-olds telling us this.
He's seen a threefold increase in kids seeking treatment since 2009, many for medical marijuana, and he fears that number will grow even larger if Amendment 64 passes. And if Colorado does become the first state to legalize, it could force a showdown with the federal government. They've given medical marijuana room to operate so far, but the Justice Department says it won't turn a blind eye if there are, quote, dangers to the community from the sale of marijuana. Ben Marcus, Colorado Public Radio News.
Well, let's take a look now at the other statewide ballot measures voters will consider this election. CPR's Zachary Barr has been studying up on them and joins us. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Ryan.
There are just two others. First, Amendment 65. What would it add to the state's constitution and, in this particular case, to state statute as well?
Well, it would add a plea to our congressional delegation to support an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. This federal amendment would limit political contributions with the end goal of reducing the influence of money in politics and elections.
The major backers of 65 are Colorado Common Cause and COPERG. And here's Elena Nunez of Common Cause.
Our elections increasingly are for sale to the highest bidder, and it is the wealthiest individuals who can write multi-million dollar checks who are having their voices heard to the detriment of the rest of us.
Are there opponents to this?
Well, there's no officially organized opposition, but of course there are people who have come out against it in columns and blogs, and they say it's silly to amend the state's constitution for this sort of purpose, and even if it does pass, it will ultimately be ineffective.
Well, let's turn to the last item that asks voters to amend the state constitution. This is Amendment S.
Yeah, state lawmakers put Amendment S on the ballot. It deals with state personnel issues, and essentially it would update the rules that govern how the state can hire people. Many state officials, Republicans and Democrats, say the system is broken and support this amendment. And here's Governor John Hickenlooper explaining one of the problems.
The way it's set up now, if you want to hire somebody in state government, say a manager, you collect resumes and people fill out forms, and then you can only interview three people. And if a couple of them drop out during the interview process, they get another job somewhere else, you can't replace them. So you end up only getting to interview one person perhaps. And if that person is not going to be the right part of the team, you have to declare a failed search and spend another 6 months, waste another 6 months before you can begin another search.
Amendment S would also increase the maximum contract length for contract workers that the state hires from 6 months to 9 months.
The reason this is amending the state constitution is that's where personnel rules live.
Precisely. So the state constitution has to be amended in order just to change those rules.
Tell us about the opposition to Amendment S, Zach.
Well, opponents have organized under the name Colorado Citizens for Good Government. Miller Hudson is a spokesman. He's a former executive director of the Colorado Association of Public Employees, also a former Democratic state representative. His main objection to Amendment S is that the governor would now be allowed to directly appoint people to several hundred state jobs, thereby circumventing the hiring rules. The governor does have this power now, but it would be greatly expanded.
And so the real question is, the governor currently has 125 political appointees, and does any governor really need 320 political appointments in order to control state government?
And Hudson says that the current governor, or any future governor, could use these political appointments to pursue his or her own political agenda, thereby opening the door to cronyism or nepotism. And he's also concerned that Amendment S's passage would allow managers to use more subjective criteria when hiring new state employees. They might choose more charismatic people instead of the most skilled ones. And fundamentally, Hudson just believes that the current system works well and protects against potential problems.
What are the chances Amendment S will become law?
Well, Amendment S's main obstacle probably isn't that group I just mentioned, but a lack of publicity. When people aren't familiar with something on the ballot or they just don't understand it, they're inclined to vote no. And many people don't know about Amendment S because it hasn't had much of an advertising budget for or against. For instance, there aren't any TV ads running right now that talk about Amendment S.
Zach, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Zachary Barr is a reporter and producer at CPR. He'll be back with us in the second half of the show with a report on the growing influence of Hispanic voters here. They're critical, given how tight the presidential race is. But that's not the only toss-up in Colorado. Control of this state house is very much in question. Republicans hold a one-seat majority, which they're hoping to widen, but the Democrats want to erase. We're going to consider what this election could mean for policy at the state house, a building CPR's Megan Verlee spends a lot of time in as our Capitol reporter. Hi, Megan.
Hey, Ryan.
Policy is going to depend hugely on who controls what chamber. So let's quickly run through the scenarios. One is the GOP could hold on to the House. Democrats could keep the Senate, where they now have a five-seat majority. In other words, things could stay roughly the same.
That's right. Another possibility is Democrats could gain control of the House and keep that majority in the Senate. That would put the full legislature and the governor's seat all in Democratic hands. The last time we saw that was in 2010. The other option is that Republicans could hold on to the House and sweep all the most contested seats in the Senate. It's a long shot, but that would give us an entirely GOP legislature.
Okay. Well, what are the issues at stake?
The most obvious, I think, are a couple of big Democratic agenda items that died last session and which they've promised to bring back. The first is civil unions, and the second is a college tuition break for undocumented immigrants. It's not quite in-state tuition, but it's a whole lot less than they have to pay now. For civil unions, you'll recall last spring, it had the votes to pass but was killed by the House Republican leadership and then died again in a special session right after the regular session. That issue has been the focus of big fundraising efforts by Democrats, and they have to follow through with that if they win control of the legislature. Most Republicans, of course, still oppose both that tuition break for undocumented students and civil unions. So if they retain control of the House, the outcome will likely be the same next year as it was this year.
Now, one of the most important functions of a state legislature is to pass a balanced budget. Are leaders talking about how the approach to that might change next year?
Yes, they are. And more specifically, what to do with any extra money if the state runs a surplus, which it's projected to do, a small surplus, but a big enough one to fight over. It's pretty clear there are likely to be about 100 different views on how to spend that money.
100 views, because there are 100 lawmakers.
Exactly. I talked with the Senate Majority Leader, John Morse. He's a Democrat. He thinks it's important to give state workers a raise, which is something they haven't had for several years now. I talked with Frank McNulty, the House Speaker, a Republican. He says the extra money should go to education and transportation construction. I talked to the House Assistant Majority Leader, Mark Waller, same party, same chamber as the House Speaker. He wants the state to start making up the shortfall in the fire and police pension fund. I asked Waller about all these different views.
When you have money to fight over, then you fight over the money. Obviously, when you don't have money to fight over, there's nothing to fight about. So it has the potential, certainly, to be more contentious going into the next legislative session.
Mark Waller there, the assistant House Majority Leader. Megan, the last time the legislature was in the control of one party was 2 years ago under the Democrats. Is history any guide if they win both chambers on election night?
I don't really think so, because there's a very different governor in the office this time around. Bill Ritter had a very active agenda in the state house. He spearheaded some big policy changes around green energy, increasing the renewable energy standard in the state to 30%, requiring some power plants to switch from coal to natural gas. Those were controversial positions, and he really took the lead on them. Ritter didn't mind if he angered Republicans along the way, and he often did it. Now you've got John Hickenlooper, who hasn't really pushed much of a legislative agenda in the past two sessions besides getting the budget through, and who has built a reputation on bipartisanship. In fact, I've heard quite a few people say that the person who most doesn't want to see Democrats in control of both chambers is Hickenlooper.
Who's a Democrat himself? That doesn't make any sense, right?
Well, I think the point they're trying to make there is that Hickenlooper, being very moderate and valuing having a decent relationship with the Republicans, may be under pressure to veto some of the legislation that could come out of his own party.
If both chambers were controlled by Democrats and there were no sort of Republican brake on the accelerator.
Exactly. Now, I think that will actually depend a lot on how much party leaders are willing to rein in their more liberal members. For instance, there were a number of Democrats last session who introduced bills that put restrictions on oil and gas development, especially in urban areas, responding to the development that's going on the Front Range. The governor's made it clear he supports the industry. He doesn't think that sweeping regulatory change is needed. So if those bills come back and make it through a Democratic legislature, that could be tough for Hickenlooper politically. And I will say that if Democrats win the House, he's pretty likely to face that. I talked with Senator Morgan Carroll of Aurora. She's a leading member of her caucus in the Senate, and she says she'll still pursue changes to oil and gas regulations, even if that means a veto.
My job is to represent my district. And I don't think that I can, in good conscience, you know, face the people in my district and tell them that I've done everything I can to protect the safety of them, their families, and their kids.
That's Morgan Carroll from Aurora. And all of that said, party leaders still have ways of making sure politically uncomfortable bills die, even from their own members. One is to send them to so-called kill committees, where they know they will be buried. So I can imagine there will be a lot of negotiations between the governor and the legislature, if Democrats control both chambers, to try and keep bills like that off his desk.
So that he doesn't have to veto something.
Exactly.
You kill it earlier. We've been talking a lot about Democrats because they only have to win a couple of seats to take control of both chambers. It would be harder for Republicans to win back the Senate because Democrats have a 5-seat majority there, as we've said. But if Republicans were to take both chambers, do you have a sense of what policies they'd like to see pass?
Certainly, although even with total control of the legislature, they'd still have to deal with a Democratic governor. But there are some policies from recent years they think they have his support on. For instance, creating a hard driving under the influence limit for THC, that's the active ingredient in marijuana. There was a bill to do that that died by one vote during the special session. It's coming back again next session, and with a Republican majority, it would almost certainly go to the governor.
Anything else?
Well, there are a number of gun rights bills that Republicans have advocated for in recent years, allowing concealed carry without a permit, expanding the right to use deadly force in self-defense to people who are at work. I think you would definitely see a lot of those pass under a Republican majority. The governor, I asked his office whether he would support or veto those, and they're not taking a position right now.
Well, speaking of gun laws, the issue of tightening them came up at the second presidential debate when a member of the audience asked this.
President Obama, during the Democratic National Convention in 2008, you stated you wanted to keep AK-47s out of the hands of criminals. What has your administration done or planned to do to limit the availability of assault weapons?
Now, in his answer, President Obama mentioned the movie theater shooting in Aurora, and he raised the possibility of reintroducing the assault weapons ban. Are Democrats at the state level saying something similar?
Honestly, not that I've heard. The state senator whose district includes the theater is actually Morgan Carroll, who we heard from a few minutes ago. She says she's researching what steps other states have taken to reduce violence, but she's not committing to anything that involves guns right now, and she says she's not hearing that from other lawmakers either.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I haven't actually seen any gun control legislation in my time covering the state capitol, and that's 3 sessions now. There's a very strong pro-gun lobby in the state, and for Democrats in vulnerable districts, pursuing gun control could very well cost them their seats. And in the Senate, that could very well cost them their majority.
Megan, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ryan.
Megan Verlee covers the state capitol for Colorado Public Radio. And as we heard, education funding's been a big issue in state races. It's also an issue voters will consider directly as school districts across the state ask them to decide on more than $1 billion worth of spending this election. Denver's request alone is about $500 million. Let's talk now with CPR's education reporter Jenny Brundine about what school districts from Jefferson County to St. Vrain say are their most pressing needs. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Ryan.
School districts have faced 4 years of state budget cuts, but this was the first year that state lawmakers held funding steady. So given that, why do districts feel they need to go to voters for money?
Well, during those tough years, many districts cut programs. They increased class sizes and they dipped into reserves. Some of these requests are to restore programs that have been cut, but also to prevent new cuts as student populations grow, but funding doesn't. Listeners might not be familiar with the severity of cuts in some districts like this one.
We cut our counseling staff basically in half. We have suspended our gifted and talented program except for a half-time employee to take care of personal plans for our gifted kids. We have totally suspended the secondary remedial reading program as far as teachers who work as interventionists in that area. And we're hoping that we can give pay raises to staff who haven't had a pay raise in 4 years.
That's Jo Barbie. She's the superintendent of Weld County School District RE1, just southwest of Greeley. Students at her district already attend only 4 days a week. She made that change this year. The district is asking voters for a property tax increase, formerly called a mill levy, an average of about $2 a month. If it doesn't pass, Barbie says they'll be forced to increase class sizes, fire teachers, and maybe even close some schools. There is no organized opposition in this district.
Well, what about class sizes? I understand the larger districts in the state have had to increase class sizes after those 4 years of cuts. Are there districts hoping to bring class sizes down with their property tax proposals?
Yes. In fact, that's the big goal of the St. Vrain Valley School District, the state's ninth largest district in Longmont. Here's what they've been dealing with.
We have classrooms, certainly PE classes that are over 50, elective classes that are 35 to 40, and some of our core classes are now up to 35 at the secondary level.
Gosh, I think back to all the horsing around in my PE classes. I can't imagine one's 50 students with just one teacher.
Yes, that is a lot of crowd control. We heard just there from Terry Schuler, St. Vrain's chief financial officer. Like the majority of districts, it's operating at 2008 funding levels with many more students now.
There's also a number of bond measures on the ballots. These are different.
These are different, yes. There are 21 school bond measures across the state. These figures come from the Colorado School Finance Project, and we have a link to them on our website. Some bond proposals are for new buildings, but most districts are trying to repair leaky roofs or replace old cooling and heating units that are siphoning money. And some of these bond measures require voters to match state grants.
Give me an example of a district that's going after this kind of matching money.
One is the tiny district serving the towns of Genoa and Hugo on the Eastern Plains. An audit showed it'll take $10 million to get their school buildings up to code. Many of the classrooms have one or no electrical sockets.
Wow.
And teachers can't use extension cords because that's a fire code violation, making it hard for this school to even use their computers. And it has another problem.
We have some major structural issues where the building has sunk into our unique soil in Hugo. And so literally one end of the building you can see is sinking. It's still attached, but it falls off probably a good foot from the level of the rest of the building.
That's Frank Reeves, the district superintendent. It's hardly a surprise they want to build a new school, so they're asking voters to match the state grant.
How does Frank Reeves think voters will respond?
He's hopeful. He's been getting positive feedback, but he's also hearing from some in this ranching community that it isn't a good year. The lack of rain has meant no crops, and that's forced ranchers and farmers to buy hay to feed their cattle. And some of those folks say, as a result, they have no extra money.
Let's turn to Colorado's largest school district, Jefferson County. Give us a snapshot of where Jeffco stands right now.
Well, it gets $761 less per student from state dollars than it did in 2009. That's meant closing schools, trimming staff, streamlining administration, and cutting staff salaries 2 years in a row by 3% each year.
And in Jeffco, there's issue 3A on the ballot. It's a property tax increase. Tell us about it.
It would generate about $40 million a year, and that's to maintain class size, bring back 2 days of school that the districts had to cut, and keep many electives. Now, issue 3B, the bond, will provide $99 million for repairing aging schools. Backers say both measures would cost the average homeowner about $3 a month.
So of all the districts, Jefferson County seems to be painting the bleakest picture of what might happen if 3A and 3B don't pass.
Yes, district leaders say they're looking at $45 million in cuts. That's about 600 jobs, including nearly 400 teaching positions. So gone would be music programs in elementary and middle schools, teacher librarians, and they say average elementary class sizes would climb to 31 students. At the high school level, Superintendent Cindy Stevenson says they would have to cut some smaller elective classes that don't serve tons of kids, but that many students and parents feel are crucial.
So now you're going to be faced with losing teachers. Do you run an advanced placement physics class that has 18 kids? Do you run a reading class that has 12 kids? We believe that those choices are incredibly important for kids.
Who are the critics in Jefferson County?
There's one group, Jeffco Students First, that is opposing both 3A and 3B. They argue that the district's budget is adequate, and they say the real problem is mismanagement. Also, a lone Jeffco school board member, Laura Boggs, disagrees with the notion of putting the district into debt.
So, you know, think about your household. If you have a 7-year-old, we're going to ask that 7-year-old for the next 20 years, we're going to be putting that family in debt to pay for ongoing maintenance things in the school district. I think that's bad public policy.
Boggs wants to see more administrative cuts and a complete overhaul of teacher pay. Superintendent Stevenson, meanwhile, counters that the district has won national recognition for being effective and efficient.
You're listening to Colorado Matters. I'm Ryan Warner, and as part of CPR's election coverage, Colorado Votes, we're checking in on some of the education-related ballot measures throughout the state with our education reporter, Jenny Brundin. And let's move to Denver, an 85,000-student district, and it's going to voters for a property tax hike and a bond measure. Give us a snapshot of DPS's financial situation.
Denver is getting $800 less per student from the state than it did 3 years ago, a 10% drop. And remember, that's a cut from a level of state funding that's among the lowest in the nation. And Denver is also the fastest growing large district in the country.
Huh. Well, Denver has two measures, as we mentioned. There's a bond, 3B, and a mill levy, a property tax hike, 3A. What would the property tax hike do?
It's a $49 million proposal. About a quarter of it would go to improving programs like art, music, and physical education. It also provides money for technology and tutoring in all schools. It expands preschool to more 4-year-olds and gives all kids access to full-day kindergarten.
And what about the bond?
The district estimates it has about $2 billion in building needs, but this measure would raise just under $500 million to be repaid over 25 years. They'd use about half the bond for repairs. Mike Yankovich, who served on a committee that studied district needs, says his eyes were opened after touring Denver's schools.
I saw places where the drinking water, although it was safe, had rust in it, where it was hot and the ventilation through deferred maintenance wasn't there for our children. I could go on and on, but the reality was there are significant needs that, to me, are very baseline.
Another chunk of the bond money would address overcrowding in existing schools, and some would go to building new schools.
And that part, building new schools, is controversial. One board member has publicly opposed 3B, the bond measure.
Yes, there's some concern that too much of the bond is going towards building new schools in fast-growing areas like Stapleton. Opponents argue there are 1,000 available seats at nearby Manuel High School. So they say, why are we building a new school? Here's parent Kelly Euler telling the school board more of the bond should go to existing schools.
And then I remembered how my 10-year-old sat in a 100-degree classroom on the third floor of his old school.
That's right.
How is that fair? The money for this bond is going primarily to new construction. Kids like my son will suffer because we stay in our neighborhood schools. We stay in our community schools.
Now, Stapleton parents argue vehemently that there is a great need for a new school near that neighborhood. But Euler's comment shows that some feel there isn't equity in where the new schools are going. We should clarify that only a quarter of the bond would go to new buildings in areas with the greatest population growth, like Stapleton, Southwest Denver, and the Northeast.
If voters approve both measures, what's the cost to households?
For a typical residence, about $143 per year or $12 per month.
Some voters might be wondering if there's fat to cut, say, at the central office or in administration.
Yeah, a lot of voters ask this question. Only 5% of DPS's money is spent centrally on things like curriculum or professional development or information technology, and that's among the lowest of districts nationally. The district says it's cut and cut administration and dipped into reserves, and the next step, without more funds, would be to increase class sizes.
Well, Jenny, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Jenny Brundin is Colorado Public Radio's education reporter. I'm Ryan Warner, and you're listening to our Colorado Votes election special. We'll take a break and then learn how the presidential candidates are reaching out to the state's Hispanic voters. Plus, a Denver couple that found love but not political common ground, and graphic designers take on the campaign logos. This is Colorado Matters.
Vote for Mr. Rhythm, raise up your voice, and vote for Mr. Rhythm, the people's choice. You'll be happy with them. Take my advice and vote for Mr. Rhythm. I'm voting twice. Everyone's a friend of his. His campaign slogan.
Vote for me. You got to vote for me. I'm a winner, baby.
Welcome back to a Colorado Votes election special from Colorado Public Radio. I'm Ryan Warner. A look now at Hispanic voters and efforts by both political parties to earn their support. Around 1 in 7 voters in Colorado is Latino, and historically, they favored the Democratic Party. 4 years ago, President Obama won 61% of their votes. Mitt Romney's campaign has said to win, it must chip away at that advantage. But as CPR's Zachary Barr reports, so far, it's been tough sledding.
Both campaigns connect with Hispanic voters in the same ways they talk to all voters, through rallies, ads, and phone calls, knocking on doors. But one tactic is especially popular when it comes to Latino outreach, the surrogate. First, Mitt Romney's.
Growing up, I never imagined a little girl from a border town could one day become a governor.
Estos últimos años han sido muy difíciles para nuestras familias.
I am proud to introduce to you the next president of the United States of America, Mitt Romney.
Some of Mitt Romney's top surrogates, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Luis Fortuño, the governor of Puerto Rico, and former New Mexico governor Susana Martinez. Now, interestingly, the decision to use surrogates is based in science.
There's been actually a lot of academic research on this.
Gabriel Sanchez is associate professor of political science at the University of New Mexico and a researcher for Latino Decisions, a political opinion firm.
If you send somebody they trust, somebody from their community, somebody they might identify with, at least pay attention to hear the message.
Perhaps Mitt Romney's most relied upon surrogate is his bilingual son, Craig Romney.
Muy buenas tardes. It's a pleasure to estar con ustedes. It's great to be with you all here today.
Today, Craig Romney's headlining a small outreach event at a campaign office in Thornton. A dozen or so volunteers work the phones, calling unaffiliated voters.
Sí, buenas tardes, señora. Mi nombre es Margie. Estoy llamando con un breve mensaje.
Margie Rabassa is an accountant and a Romney supporter.
This is my first time doing the Spanish script, but I have customers that I speak about Romney in Spanish to every day.
She tells them Romney is the man to fix the economy. And that's also Craig Romney's message, one he gives in Spanish-language TV ads at the Republican National Convention and at dozens of events like this one.
Traditionally, a lot of Hispanics tend to lean Democrat, but I think a lot of the issues that are important to them are issues that are important to my father. You know, strong families, strong economy, strong schools. You know, those are things that are important and things that my father's prepared to lead on.
The big issue Craig Romney leaves out? Immigration. A recent poll reveals that immigration, along with the economy, are the two issues that matter most to Colorado Hispanics. During the primaries, Mitt Romney said illegal immigrants should self-deport, but he softened his stance, saying young people who serve in the military should become permanent residents. This comes in the wake of President Obama's announcement in June of a new program called Deferred Action.
The president took action to lift the shadow of deportation from a generation of young
Latinos and Latinas who came to this country without any say on their own.
Y como presidente, su valentía me ha hecho recordar que ningún obstáculo es muy grande.
That was Obama speaking Spanish, plus surrogates Federico Peña, the former Denver mayor, and San Antonio mayor Julian Castro, all touting the administration's order to stop deporting many young illegal immigrants. And while this move plays well in the Hispanic community, it doesn't automatically mean more votes. Paul Lopez is a Democrat on Denver's city council.
Today, we're going to go knock on doors. Today, we're going to go organize. Today, we're going to go turn out the vote, and it's going to be done by your hands, by our hands.
At a West Denver campaign office, around 100 Obama supporters listen to Lopez's speech as they prepare to hit the streets. Angela Padilla has been volunteering for weeks.
Well, I've been walking around the neighborhood with a clipboard, making sure that people are registered to vote.
Padilla, who's bilingual, says when she goes door to door, she emphasizes the president's record on health care. She and others here today are motivated knowing Obama's advantage among Latinos remains strong. Polls in Colorado and nationwide show support hovering around 70%, putting it above 2008 levels. Mark Hugo Lopez is associate director of the Pew Hispanic Center. He says the Obama campaign is in a position to turn that support into action.
There's a lot of potential votes in the Hispanic vote, many people who are not voters but who could potentially be voters.
Zachary Barr, Colorado Public Radio News.
Around this time 4 years ago, newlyweds Jevon and Sarah Branyan had the first big fight of their marriage. It was over presidential politics. Jevon had always voted for Republicans, Sarah for Democrats. 4 years later, the couple is still together, happily. They found better ways to work out their differences. Maybe there are some lessons here for elected leaders. I asked them about that fight back in 08.
Yeah, it was a pretty good one. There was some stomping and some door slamming, for sure.
What triggered it?
It was when President Barack Obama made history by becoming the first African-American president. And I was jumping up and down, and he was stomping throughout the House.
So this is election night.
Election night, yep.
Of 2008.
It still makes me kind of roll my eyes a little bit.
What's the disagreement?
I was excited. I had given money. I had campaigned for him. But we hadn't really talked about it. We were only 10 months into our marriage at this point. So he was sort of shocked how happy I was, and I was sort of shocked of how unhappy he was.
Jevon, what was going through your mind that night?
I don't know. Just, you know, my guy didn't win. And
you'd voted for McCain.
Yeah.
And we went into it thinking we are crossing each other out. We are canceling each other's vote. So, you know, we had a little non-attachment to it at that point. But then, you know, there's always going to be a winner.
What's the biggest issue you guys disagree on?
The economy and how we're going to get it back on track.
Do you agree, Jevon, about the economy?
And I do remember him saying on election night, well, there goes your economy. Hold on to your job, Sarah. And honestly, it wasn't so far off the truth. So that's where I can respect him, because he could see things that were going to happen. And that wasn't the most important thing to me, honestly. Civil rights, women's issues are more important.
How did you guys meet?
We met on a plane. I was running through the terminal because I was late and caught his eye when I got onto the plane. And I said, I will give you $100 if you have a bottle of water. Mm-hmm. That was breaking the ice.
And then I asked her what her time in the marathon was. She was like huffing and puffing.
I was. Yeah. And we just had an incredible conversation for the 3 hours that it took. Then he gave me a movie line to ask for my phone number. Do you want to recreate that moment?
No. It's all right. Because I don't want everybody using it. We'll have too many people meeting on planes, and it'd just be a bad idea.
But he got my number, is how it happened. And then I remember coming home, and I told my roommates, you guys, I just met the most incredibly handsome, intriguing man. But he's a Republican. True.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
she's like, I could never date somebody like
that. Yeah, I could never date somebody like that, is what I told them. Yeah. And then 2 days later, he started calling, and the rest is history. We were married inside of a year, so little did I know.
It sounds like you guys have gotten to a slightly better place than when you were first married in terms of the politics. Agreeing to disagree? How has that changed over time?
Well, I think we're just way more understanding. I personally thought of it as like a win-loss proposition, and you really can't think of it like that. Like, 'cause at the end of the day, like I still love Sarah. And so our political differences like shouldn't get in the way of that. And I should strive more to understand where she is coming from rather than try and conquer her, you know, intellectually. But
is it that it used to be about winning and it's not anymore, like winning the argument?
Yeah,
it is.
For sure. One of us felt like we needed to be right and we wouldn't stop until we were. And I think we used to make assumptions about each other. Like I would assume that because he voted a certain way that he hated women or he hated minorities or something. And he's like, you have no idea where I'm coming from. Can I tell you where I come from? Right. And that was the beginning of all understanding, is to ask each other.
Yeah. And if you want people to understand your perspective for things, like you have to open up and be able to listen to them as well.
I'm curious, Sarah, when you got off that plane and you ran back and told your friends, I met this great guy. He's a Republican. Like, how did you change your frame of mind? Because at that point, you didn't think it would ever be possible, right?
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of things. He was brought up in a private Christian school, chose to go to a private Christian college. has always been a Christian, has always been a Republican, has always been pretty conservative. And I just thought that meant that he had never thought for himself, which was a judgment on my part that was not true. And I think the moment that I noticed that, I had changed my mind. I was brought up pretty conservative and went to college and decided to start thinking for myself and doing different things than my parents had or that my community had. And I thought that that my path was the right path. And I had to realize it was my judgment holding me back. And he's very romantic. And so, you know, I got distracted from the issues. I got distracted for a while, you know.
Jevin, I hear that judgment from Sarah. That stings. She thought you didn't think for yourself. Do you remember when she told, did she ever tell you that?
Yeah, she has before. And, you know, and that's, I mean, but that's why you do talk about things. I mean, we find out stuff about each other all the time.
Did you have judgments about her?
You know, honestly, I don't know. I'd like to say I was the bigger person. but there's not really much to judge from her end because she does really want to help people. And she does genuinely care about people. And so I can understand where she is coming from.
Do you think that there is something political leaders could learn from your marriage?
Whoa.
You can get along.
Yeah.
For sure.
And you can get along and you can be productive.
You can be productive.
Yeah, imagine that.
We got out of debt. One of our biggest accomplishments is we had $64,000 worth of debt when we got married. Between student loans and cars, and in 18 months we got rid of it. So let's expand that up to, you know, Congress and the national debt, and let's get it done.
Yeah, and we had to make a lot of sacrifices.
A ton of sacrifices.
And I think that's one of the things that gets in the way is I think a lot of people aren't willing to make those sacrifices.
How are you guys navigating this election year? I mean, are there things you avoid? Do you watch different televisions so that you don't...
Well, I could safely say for one that we're both tired of political advertisements.
Oh, for sure.
And I think we both know how we're going to vote. We basically scheme how we can get the other person to miss election day.
That is exactly where I was going with it.
we don't just cancel each other out. That way one of our vote counts. So yep.
Like I throw away anything that comes from Romney. I just throw away before he gets home, kind of like what you did with your report card with your mom. You know, or like we just do that kind of stuff, or I need to get away to put in a call bank time for Obama, and I just, you know, I'm at the grocery store, stuff like that.
Right, and I've called her work and told them to schedule her out of town for election day. And she hopes it snows a lot, so I go snowboarding. And
actually, we both agree that we need to vote, and it's so important that even if we cancel each other out, I'd rather it happen that way.
We'll probably drive there together.
Yeah.
Well, unless I take the battery out of her car.
Well, Jevin, Sarah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
No problem. Thanks.
Husband and wife Jevin and Sarah Branyon live in Denver. They reached out through our Public Insight Network and told us about their politically divided household. And by the way, if you're curious about Jevin's cheesy pickup line in the airplane, we asked him afterwards to share it with us.
So I asked her for a number, and she said, "What for?" And I said, "Just in case." And she's like, "Just in case of what?" And I said, "Just in case of life."
We'll let you judge the quality of that line. But earlier this week, we let two Denver graphic designers judge the campaign logos in the presidential and congressional races. Rick Griffith runs a design studio called Matter, and Eli Gerson is a partner at the firm Design and Image. We should say that neither had a hand in designing the logos we'll talk about. Rick, Eli, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Let's start at the top of the ticket with a race for president. I really like the Romney-Ryan double R logo with that cascading front leg of the R. What do you guys think?
Well, first of all, I mean, it seems to be three R's. So, I mean, we have to ask the question of who else is on the ticket.
You know, I'd have to give Romney some credit. I think they broke away a little bit from the standard Republican look and feel of the stoic, conservative serif fonts that represent the most of the logo with the exception of the R. However, I think the R, while trying to be, I think, a little softer than the conservative look and feel, is a failure. Yes, it's three R's. I think what he's trying to do is the second read of three people. Those people, to me, look very blobbish. I'm not sure what they're – I mean, they're not inspirational. They're not really together. I think that's what he's trying to achieve. But when I see it, I just want to brush my teeth.
Actually the thing that I was going to mention as well.
It feels like a crest.
It looks like toothpaste.
Toothpaste in the '90s. Yeah, they had the three swirls in it so that you could deodorize and brighten and whiten.
Exactly.
And maybe the cinnamon flavor.
It's a fresh campaign.
Let's go to Barack Obama's. This is largely unchanged from 08. And the designer said that he was looking at the O in Obama's name and thought of a rising sun and a new day. Is this a good logo to have stuck with?
I think that Obama changed the game 4 years ago, and they put so much effort into this brand. I can't think of any other candidate where all you can see is that O on the bumper sticker of somebody's car and know exactly who that candidate is.
Without any words.
Tremendously successful. And he also, I think, was able to use the standard flag, red and white stripes, but to do so in a more unique fashion. It does look like a sunrise. It looks like a new hope. And I think that's where it's successful.
The bright shade of blue here is the big takeaway for me. Most of the time, you're seeing a very navy blue. And this blue, I mean, from a brand perspective, it works more like the Tiffany blue. And it's such a beautiful sort of radiant color that you can't help to sort of feel optimistic when you see it. It's not like this dark navy blue that everything sort of responds to by contrast. It might as well be black. But in the world of brand, you know, deploying devices that work on multiple senses is really, really helpful. And in this case, you could see this beautiful blue from a distance and really know what it does.
Well, let's move to the congressional races in Colorado. We had you look over some yard signs beforehand for the tightest races. And I don't know, anything grab your eye, good or bad?
Right away, the typeface deployed for Joe McCloskey, who's a Democrat running in the 6th.
That's right, Joe McCloskey, and he's running against a Republican, Mike Kaufman.
Yeah, that typeface was deployed for McCain 4 years ago, and the last time we saw that typeface deployed, it was on a Republican ticket.
Eli, what do you think when you look at the congressional yard signs?
I guess with Joe, one thing I would give him credit for is at least adding a little bit of personality with his tagline, "Not your average Joe." I'm not so sure how exciting that I am about that tagline, but at least there is some personality there.
Joe's really only one of two candidates who has a slogan. You have Ed Perlmutter, the Democrat running in the 7th against Republican Joe Kors, and his is "Our Neighbor, Our Voice."
Right. And I think any time that these candidates can take that opportunity to instill some personality, some idea of their platform, more the better. Most of these, I think, are lacking opportunity.
I like the what's going on with Congressman Perlmutter's piece, where subliminally you're thinking the word "mutter" in the background and the word "voice" in this tagline, sort of like one thing creates this internal punism, and you just sort of play with it in your head and it becomes memorable. I'm sure it's not hurting him.
I had never thought of the "mutter" part of the Perlmutter name, and then he uses the phrase "our voice."
I mean, I don't like puns,
but
it's punny and through that becomes, you know, memorable and somewhat funny.
Let's move to the images in the 4th District. So this is the race between Democrat Brandon Schaefer and Republican Cory Gardner. Gardner really is the only candidate who's using a symbol other than a flag, a star, a stripe. He's got, Eli, describe what you're seeing there.
I think Cory Gardner is one of the few candidates that's taking his cue from Obama from 4 years ago. He might disagree with it, but in fact, he is doing it by creating this icon, this logo, which is not your standard boring flags and stars. Instead, he's saying, "I am a man of the people. I am a local person. I'm amongst the mountains, the farms. I care about the common man."
He's got a farm there, a barn. It looks like a silo and mountains in the distance.
I think Eli's quite accurate here. Candidate Gardner is using a number of different tools to create a narrative, and I think it's very successful for him. What that narrative is limited by these icons now, and I'm not sure if that's all that's at stake for him.
So he might be boxing himself in with a logo like this?
Well, it's hardly aspirational. They're objects. They're environment and tools of a particular craft. So I don't think that they have the aspirational components that perhaps the Obama logo has,
a sunrise.
Yeah, sunrise, right, a new day. But I think he is making a connection to his constituency.
What do you think is the least successful image you're looking at?
I'm going to say it's going to be Scott Tipton.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Scott, but it looks like someone very young and very inexperienced designed this logo.
Scott Tipton is the Republican running against Sal Pace in the 3rd District. What gives you the sense that he's inexperienced? It's a nice, bold Tipton. You've got the stars and stripes, and it's red, white, and blue, right? Those are all of the things you have to hit.
All of the things that do not make you stand out compared to what Pace is doing, where he's taking advantage of the Colorado flag and really taking kind of a contemporary stylistic spin on that. Scott's font is bold. It's also a little horsey.
Horsey is a word that only we know. I think you need to talk about what horsey means.
I think that's true, because I'm trying to find, like, you know, that, a mane and tail.
Gardner is really literally horsey.
Yeah,
but
that's true. Tipton.
So what does horsey mean exactly?
Horsey means basically to scale too big. If you think of a person's relationship to a horse, you can't see over the middle of it.
Okay.
So it's sort of like right here in front of you and just too damn big. You know?
Right. I have no other opportunity but to see this Tipton and how poorly spaced the letter forms are. It's very amateur.
Pace, on the other hand, as you've mentioned, integrates the C from the Colorado flag. And is really one of the few to do that, to make this feel like, oh, this is not a race that could be in New Jersey.
That's a big opportunity for him. I think a four-letter name with a single syllable, with a Colorado. I mean, he could win it strictly on trade dress, if you will.
Trade dress.
Yeah, you know, that's what we call logos and marks. Trademarks.
I love all these terms. It's so exciting.
I mean, Scott Tipton looks like he's running a branch of the USPS. It looks like he is the guy to entrust with a package.
I think it's good. You look at the two icons that they're each using to represent their logo. Scott Tipton has used the flag and the stars in no necessary conceptual way, whereas Pace has taken the Colorado flag and sketched it as if to say, I'm going to take a new take on Colorado.
Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Eli Gerson is with the firm Design and Image. Rick Griffith's design studio is called Matter. They're both in Denver. And our conversation adds a little laughter, at least we hope, to Colorado Votes, CPR's election coverage, which our assistant news director, Judith Smelser, coordinated. You can hear every story and interview in the series at cpr.org. I'm Ryan Warner, and this is Colorado Public Radio.